Now we can start. Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming this afternoon. It's my pleasure and privilege to welcome Professor Lord John Krebs for his second lecture in the Messenger Lecture Series. The third one will be on Monday at 5 o'clock. For those who were not at his first lecture last Wednesday, I will briefly recapitulate. Lord Krebs obtained his doctorate at Oxford in 1970, studying the effects of behaviour on great tit populations in Whiteham Woods. Before becoming an administrator and politician, as he is today, he has made many, many important contributions to science. His two textbooks on behavioral ecology with Nick Davis have been used the last 30 years around the world by anybody who teaches behavioral ecology. He is, to my knowledge, the only biologist who has been both the president of the International Society for Behavioral Ecology on the one hand and of the Association of Animal Behavior on the other hand. He has published more than 300 papers and several books, and for those who know what this means, his H-index is an astounding 55. When elected to the Royal Society, he was its youngest fellow. Further to memberships in many learned societies, the list is too long actually to enumerate, which include the Academia Europea and the US Academy, National Academy of Sciences, he has received 15 honorary degrees. He was knighted for service to behavior ecology in 1999, and today he is Baron of Whiteham, and as such, he's a member of the House of Lords, where he chairs the Select Committee on Science and Technology as an independent crossbencher. And what this means is too long to explain. You know, if you want to ask him afterwards, I'm sure he can do that. He did this last night. When the British government was confronted with the problem of mad cow disease, BSE, they asked Sir John, chair the newly founded Food Standards Agency. And actually, he did figure out how to resolve the problem. He resigned from the Food Standards Agency in 2005 to become principal of Jesus College in Oxford. And in today's lecture, he will answer the question to the extent what food is safe. And please welcome me and help me in welcoming Professor Lord John Krebs.
Thank you, Andre, and thank you for those who've stuck it out for the second dose. I really congratulate you on your fortitude. I'm pleased to be given a bottle of Dasani water to drink because one of my high spots as chairman of the Food Standards Agency was to cause the company that makes Dasani, Coca-Cola, to withdraw it from the market in the UK within 1 month of having launched it for two reasons. One, we exposed the fact that far from being purified water enhanced with minerals, it came straight out of a tap in South London into the bottle. And secondly, it had minute, in the purification process, they'd managed to add minute quantities of benzene. So that was one of my great successes against corporate power. But today, I'm going to start off talking about my experiences as chairman of the Food Standards Agency, really building on some of the themes that I introduced in the previous lecture about risk, acceptability of risk, and responsibility for managing risk. And then later on in the lecture, I'm going to move to looking to the future and how we are going to rise to the challenge of feeding 9 billion people in 2050. So the talk will have four themes, really. What do we mean by safe? What do we mean by healthy? Whose responsibility is it to deal with these matters? And then talking about all, meaning not just thinking of us in this room and in the developed world, but thinking about other people who are less fortunate than us in the amount of food that they have. Now, the first question, what is safe, is something that we in the United Kingdom gave a huge amount of thought to after the BSE crisis. And in fact, the government of the day spent roughly $40 million on an inquiry that lasted several years led by the guy who went on to become, in effect, the chairman of the Supreme Court, one of the most senior judges in the country. And he answered the question, what is safe, as follows. He said quite clearly that the government doesn't set out to reduce, to achieve zero risk, but to reduce risk to a level which should be acceptable to a reasonable consumer, which is fine. It's a very good legal statement. The only trouble is it leaves unanswered two crucial questions. What is acceptable and what is reasonable? So it still becomes a matter of judgment what you mean by safe. But just to emphasize acceptability and reasonableness, it's worth looking back in history about the history of food safety and take the common white stuff that you buy in a jug from the supermarket or from 7-Eleven and drink with impunity all the time. Well, here's what the 18th century English author Tobias Smollett said about milk in 1771. In case you can't read it at the back, but you probably can, he refers to milk as the produce of faded cabbage and sour draught, lowered with hot water, frothed with bruised snails, carried through the streets, exposed to foul rinsings discharged from doors and windows, spittle, snot, and tobacco quids, overflowing from mud carts, spatterings from coach wheels, dirt and trash chucked into it by roguish boys for the joke's sake, and spewings of infants, etc. And finally, the vermin that drops from the rags of the nasty drab that vends this precious mixture under the respectable denomination of milkmaid. So that was milk roughly 250 years ago. If we wind the clock back, wind the clock forward, should I say now, to the first half of the 20th century in the United Kingdom, milk, whilst a little bit better than that, was still a pretty dangerous stuff to drink. And in fact, roughly speaking, 2,500 people a year in the United Kingdom died as a result of drinking milk. Why was that? It was because milk was not pasteurized and many cattle had bovine tuberculosis, which got into the milk and passed on to humans, and people died of bovine TB. At that time, in the mid-1930s, so not so long ago, a bill was proposed to Parliament to make it mandatory to pasteurize milk to save 2,500 lives a year. Parliament rejected the bill on the grounds that this was disproportionate. It was perfectly acceptable for the reasonable consumer to stand a fair chance of dying as a result of drinking milk. That today would be an absolute outrage. So this concept of acceptability of risk has certainly changed with time. And here we see what was said when finally, after this study by a distinguished medic, Sir Graham Watson, said that raw milk is probably the most dangerous article in our diet, finally the government in 1949 passed a bill making pasteurization mandatory, and the then health minister said pasteurization has been prevented by ignorance, prejudice, and selfishness. So between 1935 and 1949, public perception of risk and parliamentary perception of risk, the regulatory perception of risk, had changed quite dramatically. And along with this, the first thing you can say about food safety is that the food that we all eat today is far safer than it's ever been in the past. And therefore, what's acceptable to the reasonable consumer has changed, and we are extremely risk averse, and acceptable levels of safety for us are extremely high compared with those that were acceptable to our grandparents and going back through the generations. But you wouldn't think it was necessarily like that if you look at the newspapers in the United Kingdom. This is just taken a few years ago, a few days of headlines from the tabloid press, and particularly sentences with cancer and baby food in them are extremely popular with the press, and all about, this was during mad cow disease, chips linked to tumors, farm fears as chicken disease hits Holland, and so on. So the environment in which you live as a regulator of food safety is one that is frenzied, at least in the media. And most of these stories, needless to say, are ill-founded. They're pure fiction or near fiction, but nevertheless, they create public concern if you ask people about them. And if you ask how the media reports health issues. There's a very interesting analysis of this, which was done a few years ago by a medical health charity in England called the King's Fund. And what they did is to look through the newspapers and figure out how many deaths does it need to create a single news story. And this is the table they produced. For every death as a result of smoking, it takes 8,500 of those deaths to have one story in the newspaper. In the case of mad cow disease, it takes a third of a death to create a newspaper story. And because of this was during the period when measles, mumps and rubella vaccine was a big issue and a lot of parents weren't vaccinating their kids, a quarter of a death from measles created a story. In other words, the media interest in mad cow disease at that time was about 23,000 times that of a death related to obesity, even though in retrospect the risk of mad cow disease was very much smaller. So the media are a distorting lens for the risks that we feel we might be confronted with, but in that distortion they're simply mirroring public opinion about the acceptability of risk. So that's a bit of general comment. I want to switch now to... I just want to say one more thing, which is that in fueling this interest in mad cow disease, one of the most remarkable mistakes was made by then agriculture minister, and here he is, his name is John Gummer, and that's his daughter Cordelia, who was about five at the time, and now happy to say has just graduated from Edinburgh University. But what he was doing there was eating a British beef burger, and he said, British beef is perfectly safe, and look, I'm feeding it to my five-year-old daughter to prove it. And of course, it was untrue. Beef wasn't absolutely safe. And he had also said, I know it's safe because the scientists have told me. And that was also untrue, that the scientists didn't know whether it was absolutely safe or not. So that helped to fuel this media interest in mad cow disease. But I now want to move on to talk about an example of a reaction to food safety, which is genetically modified foods, where there's been a big cultural difference between Europe and the United States. And I just want to briefly unpackage why that difference might be. When GM foods were first introduced into Europe, into the United Kingdom in 1997, this tomato puree sold by one of the leading supermarkets called Sainsbury's, and it says on it, made from genetically modified tomatoes, it was outselling the conventional equivalent. Why was that? It was 1 pence cheaper, and people thought it tasted better because this had the, it was a flavor-saver tomato which can ripen to a higher degree of ripeness without going soft and squidgy, and therefore it's sweeter, produces a sweeter puree. By about a year later, all the supermarkets had taken all GM products off the shelves as a result of a very successful campaign by certain NGOs campaigning against GM foods, supported by the press, and particularly some of the tabloid press, the Daily Mail, were very anti-GM because it made good reading, good news, good sold newspapers, and the whole public opinion profile changed. At this time, the US, then US Agriculture Secretary, Dan Glickman, came over to the UK to find out what was going on, and he was very puzzled, and he called me into the American Embassy in Berkeley Square in London and said, can you explain why the British consumer is so foolish? And I said to him, oh, well, it's not really that simple, because the way you have to look at this is about risk and benefit. And the British public may actually be being quite sensible. They may be saying, is there any benefit for this in me? And is there any risk? Well, this is a new technology. There may be some unknowns. The scientists are telling us it's okay, but we can't be absolutely sure about that. And perhaps I'm not prepared to take the risk unless I can see a big enough benefit. And he nodded intelligently and he said, I see what you mean. He said, if that tomato paste had had the Viagra gene in it, then it would have sold very well. And I said, yes, you've got it straight off. So he understood about risk and benefit. Nevertheless, the story remains that in Europe as a whole, and I'm going to come back to this a bit later on, it is purported that consumers don't want to eat genetically modified food, so the food retailers don't stock it. Now, what the European Union did at that point, they were under great pressure from the United States that was concerned about the export of soya and maize in particular, and soya and maize products, and they were going to challenge the European Union's protectionism under the label of precautionary principle through the World Trade Organization. So the European Commission came up with a plan to introduce a scheme, a very complex scheme of labeling of GM food, so that then the argument being that consumers could choose whether they wanted to eat GM food, and the Americans would be satisfied because the de facto import ban would be lifted. And that ploy worked, although I believe, and I said at the time, that this labeling scheme was unenforceable and would not be adhered to. So if you go to a retailer in the UK and pick up a baked good product, goods product that contains soya lecithin or soya flour or corn syrup or corn starch, it won't declare that that's GM, as it probably should do, because most of the world's maize and soya is now GM. So I think the supermarkets are probably lying, but there's no way of checking because there's no chemical test you can do. And when I ask the supermarkets, well, how do you guarantee this? They say, well, we have a certificate here signed by the Brazilian farmer that says that his soya is not GM. And I said, oh, that's convincing. Excellent. So the other question is it actually true that the public in Britain is anti-GM? And here is a study that the government did to find out the answer to this question. They set up a website where anybody who wanted to could log on and express their view about the perceived risks or the perceived benefits of GM food. And this was called, in a jazzy government way, the GM Nation. And out of the 60 million people in the country, 37,000 logged on. And they basically, most of them put five big risks, zero or one for benefit. So big risk and no benefit. That was the general conclusion. But luckily, at the same time, some social scientists at the University of East Anglia did a proper stratified random sample of public opinion using one of these opinion poll companies, and they got a very different result. So this was actually 37,500 responses from a very small number of individuals who repeatedly logged on and logged their concerns. If you ask what the public at large thinks, you get a much more textured picture, and the public is not apparently uniformly anti-GM. They don't think the perceived risks are absolutely enormous and the perceived benefits are absolutely zero. In fact, there are rather few in this corner, and most of the people are somewhere in the middle. It may have some benefits, it may have some risks, which is not an unreasonable position to take. So that's my little story about GM. Of course, in pure regulatory terms, the process of approving GM foods is extremely stringent and requires a great deal of data and a great deal of analysis on a case-by-case basis, whereas products that are produced by conventional breeding, like a new variety of apple, which might involve shuffling 20% of the genome to create it, a new hybrid variety, is not regulated at all. So if anything, the regulation of GM is tighter than the regulation of anything else that you might wish to eat. Now, I want to just now slightly shift to perhaps the event in my time at the Food Standards Agency for which I became the most notorious and a hate figure for some sectors of the British public and the British industry. And this is when I, relatively early on in my time, I did a television interview in which I was asked, do you think that people who buy organic food, maybe some of you buy organic food, so I'm about to become a hate figure amongst you, are they getting good value for money? And I said, well, if they think they're buying organic food in order to be healthier, then they are wasting their money, because there is no scientific evidence that organic food is healthier than food produced in any other way. And since all the industry surveys asking people why they buy organic food is because they think it's healthier, a small number think it's better for the environment, which I'm not going to talk about, but I can if you want to ask questions about it, then most people were being duped. I found last year at exactly this time I received a similar negative response from the public in Greenwich Village, where I took part in a debate with this guy, Blake Hurst, a Midwest farmer, Dennis Avery, who is some kind of retired scientist. We were speaking in favor of this motion that organic food is marketing hype, and the folks who spoke against. Here you can see beforehand we had 45% of people were against the motion, but our persuasive arguments led that 45 to go to 69% after the debate. So we lost comprehensively, and I realized we would do when I walked around Greenwich Village before the debate and every local restaurant was saying organic this, organic that. So what are the facts behind this? Why do I think organic food is marketing hype? Well, here are some of the reasons why the organic food sector claims that organic food might be healthier for you. Contains fewer pesticides, don't use GMOs, which I've just talked about, don't use antibiotics, don't use many additives, more natural, whatever that might mean, more nutritious in some way. So all of those are claims that are made. Now, in the UK, I don't know what the situation is here, the industry has been prohibited from claiming that organic food is better for you because the regulator of advertising, the Advertising Standards Authority, received a complaint and they found against the organic sector. So the organic sector has withdrawn that claim, but they make the claim by subtle, implicit means. But they're not allowed to say organic food is healthier for you because the regulator has found that there's no evidence to support that. And it's a misleading claim. Just while we're thinking about natural, because that's a very popular idea that somehow it's more natural, it's pre-industrial, it's going back to the good old days, it's worth turning back to Tobias Smollett to look at what residues on your fruit were like in the days when fruit was totally natural. And here he is in London seeing a barrow bunter, a lady selling fruit. She cleaned the dusty fruit with her own spittle. And who knows, but some fine lady of St. James Parish might admit into her delicate mouth those very cherries which had been rolled and moistened between the filthy and perhaps ulcerated chops of a St. Giles huckster. So we mustn't assume that in the good old days everything was absolutely wonderful. But let's just sort of briefly recap on some of these claims. Is organic food pesticide-free? Well, clearly not, because this is a partial list of pesticides approved for use by organic farmers, including some things which are extremely poisonous, like copper sulfate and sulfur. Interestingly, Bacillus thuringiensis, organic farmers can spray on their crops, but they can't use crops which have got the BT gene that is prevents insect attack that's been genetically inserted into the maize or other crop. So it's simply not true that organic food is made without pesticides, but even if it were, and it does indeed usually have fewer pesticide residues, we have to ask what kind of risk does that pose? And as the toxicologist Bruce Ames at the University of California pointed out many years ago, if you're worried about carcinogens and toxins in your food, boy, what you should be worried about is the naturally occurring toxins. And he calculated that if you eat sprayed fruit and vegetables that are sprayed under the regulatory regime, the total residues that you will consume in a year contain about the same number of carcinogen, same amount of carcinogen, as one cup of coffee. So any of you who've drunk a cup of coffee today should be at least as worried about that as you are about pesticide residues on your food. And just to re-emphasize that point, here are two kinds of food that we've all eaten. I bet some of you have eaten one of these foods in the last 2 or 3 days, which would not pass the regulatory regime if they were subject to the same scrutiny as pesticide residues on food. Why wouldn't they pass the regulatory regime? Because they contain toxins, in the case of potatoes, glycoalkaloids, in the case of peanuts, minute traces of aflatoxin, and those toxins, at the levels in which they occur, in peanuts and in potatoes respectively, would not be sufficiently, in quotes, safe to pass the regulatory regime. So why are they allowed on the market? Because the regulatory regime has a clause in it, both in the United States and in Europe, that says if it's stuff that people have been eating for a long time, we assume it's acceptable. So the FDA has a concept of generally recognized as safe, and we have an equivalent concept in Europe for regulating food safety. So if you're worried about carcinogens in your food, worry about the naturally occurring carcinogens and stop eating rather than worrying about the pesticide residues. Is organic food more nutritious? And there have been many, many studies of this, and this is the latest systematic review, which was published in late 2009, looking at all the studies that have been carried out of the differences in nutritional content of, let's say, organic oranges and conventionally grown oranges, or organic carrots and conventionally grown carrots. And what this concludes, as every other review has concluded, that there are no systematic differences, and any differences that occur are actually relate to differences in production methods rather than differences in organic versus conventional. They're variations within those two kinds of production. So hence I come back to my suggestion that people who buy organic food thinking it's healthier for them are being misled. Now, there are environmental arguments, which I'm not going to dwell on, but I'm happy to discuss those at the end if you wish to. But this leads me to my second question. If eating organic food isn't healthier, what do we actually mean by healthy food? And how do we determine the healthfulness of our diet? And what I'm going to show next is a slide which shows you the actual risks, one metric, a very crude metric, the number of people that die as a result of eating food from different kinds of risks. And before I show the slide, you might just to pause and think yourself, where do you think the big food risks in your life lie? And I think some of you at least will be surprised by the answer. The answer is that the really big risks in our food intake are the dietary contributions to chronic diseases, to coronary heart disease and cancer, and they vastly outweigh the risks associated with foodborne illness, Salmonella and Campylobacter, variant CJD, which is human BSE, which at this time, when I made this slide a decade ago, was accounting for maybe up to 20 deaths a year. Now it's, as I explained before, has gone away completely. Food allergy, tragic when it happens, but it's a very small number of deaths per year in the UK, and no reported deaths as a result of eating GMOs, pesticides or growth hormones. And just to put those figures in context, at the bottom, according to government statistics in the United Kingdom, about 150 people a year die as a result of choking to death on their food, and that compares with 140 people who die as a result of getting out of bed or out of a chair. So if you want a risk-free life, certainly don't get up at the end of this lecture. So the really big health risks, if we talk about healthy eating, it's about the dietary contribution to cancer and coronary heart disease. Now, whilst the regulators spend a lot of time regulating risks around GM, around food safe, food poisoning, food allergy, there's essentially no regulation of the contribution to coronary heart disease from the things that you eat in your food. When the last time there was a nutrition policy in the United Kingdom was at the beginning of the 20th century, and it arose for a very specific reason. When Britain was involved in the war against the Dutch settlers in South Africa, the Boer War, where we were trying to take over the territory of South Africa, the British army wanted to recruit more soldiers, and they had a minimum height requirement of 5'3". And they couldn't find enough people that were 5'3" tall to fill the ranks of the army. So they had to lower the requirement to 5 feet. So here's an extremely small soldier recruited into the Boer War. And as a result of that, in the early part of the 20th century, the government asked, why are people so short? And the nutrition experts came back and said, because they're badly nourished. They're not getting enough protein. They're not getting micronutrients. People didn't know about vitamins then, but basically the answer was they needed to be fed better. So the government, over the early years of the 20th century, introduced various nutrition policies to ensure that people were healthier and better fed. As we turn the corner at the beginning of the 21st century, the issue was rather different. The biggest dietary health issues are not from undernutrition in the Western world, but from overnutrition or eating the wrong things, too much of salt, too much fat, too much sugar, or just too many calories. So is there a coherent policy to deal with the new diet and health issue as there was a policy 100 years ago to deal with the old one? And the answer, as you will see, is no, there isn't. Just to put this in context, there is a sort of good news story about human health, namely that life expectancy, and these are figures for the United Kingdom, but it's similar to the United States, has increased dramatically during the last 100 years. And one of the reasons it's increased dramatically, a number of reasons, but a major factor is better nutrition. So we've had huge improvements in nutritional health over the last 100 years. And just to put these figures in context so you feel good, this works out at a current rate of change of 12 minutes per hour. So during the hour of listening to this lecture, your life expectancy has gone up by 12 minutes. So feel good about that. Obviously, it's not quite true, but the rate of change has been 12 minutes an hour. However, all the experts who look at this think that this trend is now about to go into reverse. And a primary reason why it's about to go into reverse is because of the changing prevalence of obesity. So in the United Kingdom, in the decade between 1995 and 2004, the prevalence of obesity in all age groups, most alarmingly perhaps in young children, has increased substantially. And that trend is not just a UK trend. Here are the figures for, I don't know how clearly you can see this, but for a whole range of countries, and you in the United States are up here ahead of the game, but we are all struggling to catch up as fast as we can. And most medical experts believe that, or believe perhaps the wrong word, assess that being obese, a BMI of greater than 30, reduces life expectancy by about 9 to 10 years. So this trend that we have seen of increasing life expectancy may indeed go into reverse. And if the current estimates are that obesity in the United Kingdom, or in England this is, not in the United Kingdom, causes 30,000 premature deaths a year, and you can see various other measures, in the United States it's assessed to be the second largest modifiable cause of premature death. So there is a new massive health risk. Is it related to diet? Well, this is one of the challenges for medical and scientific experts, that the causes of the obesity epidemic, as it's often described, are many and varied. And nobody knows what the relative importance of different factors are. At one level, it's very simple. If you take in more calories than you expend, you store the excess calories as fat. But intake has gone up for a whole variety of reasons, such as food has become more energy dense. There's about the same number of calories in one small bag of potato chips as in a whole cabbage. And it's easy to eat a small bag of potato chips as you walk along the road. It isn't easy to eat a whole cabbage. Food is hugely cheaper than it was even 30 or 40 years ago. There are lots of other things. People consume more when they're given a more varied diet. Food is more heavily marketed, more heavily available. And portions have got bigger, etc., etc. So there's a lot of changes that have taken place to food intake. At the same time, a lot of changes have taken place in our expenditure. Fewer people are doing heavy labor, many people do less exercise, we have warmer homes, we have labor-saving devices, etc., etc. But nobody knows exactly how these factors balance out, and this is not meant to be a comprehensive list, but that does pose a challenge for, suppose the policymakers were excited about this and wanted to do something, and they go to the experts and say, well, what are the levers that we can pull to achieve change? The experts can do no more than say, well, there's a vast list of things, oh, policymakers, and we are not sure which ones are more important and which ones are less important. So this turns to the question of whose responsibility is it? Is it actually the government to sort out and tackle the obesity crisis, or is it up to us as individuals? And in many people's view, and this is an interesting contrast, whereas if there is a food poisoning outbreak, as you've had in the United States on a number of occasions, of E. coli 0157 or Salmonella or Campylobacter, and many kids get sick and some people die, then the cry generally is the regulator ought to be doing something about it, sorting it out. But as I've shown, the figures when you stack it up in terms of mortality, and it would be the same if you looked at morbidity as a result of those causes, are far lower than the figures associated with dietary ill health. And yet there isn't a cry for, at least in the United Kingdom, and I guess not here, for the government to get on and regulate what we're allowed to eat, what kind of diet we're allowed to eat in our mix. It's generally assumed that our choice of our diet is our own personal responsibility, not the responsibility of the state. And why is that? Well, it's partly it's seen as a lifestyle choice, and I guess in general, our health, our lifestyle is our own responsibility, with a few exceptions. And if you turn back to probably the most influential political philosopher of the 19th century, whose views are still very influential in political philosophy, John Stuart Mill, he argued that the only cases where the state is justified to intervene in our lives is to prevent us from harming others, so sort of laws against killing your neighbor, to protect vulnerable people, that's why there are laws preventing children being exposed to pornography, for example, or children under a certain age being allowed to drink or smoke. That's protecting vulnerable individuals. The state has a role to provide education, Mill argued, and to provide certain public services like clean water and maybe sanitation. So Mill's view of the state's role doesn't provide a role for the state to say, you should stop eating those kinds of food and switch to a diet of lettuce and carrots and boiled chicken or whatever. However, Mill wrote his famous essay on liberty in 1859, and things have changed since then, and there are certain things that Mill didn't think of, either because he didn't think of them or because they weren't relevant. And here are some arguments why what in the United Kingdom is sometimes called the nanny state, in a pejorative sense, why the state may be justified in interfering in our lives to adjust our diets. And there are just three that I've listed here, not an exhaustive list. Perhaps the easiest one to think of is the middle one. When Mill wrote his essay, there was no such thing as the food industry. Nowadays, the food industry largely determines what we eat and what goes into the food we eat. And just as the government saw it as appropriate to regulate the tobacco industry and the drinks industry and what they're allowed to promote and sell and to whom, there could be an argument that says it's not restricting our freedoms if the government regulates the food industry and tells them what they're allowed to put into food and how they're allowed to market it. So that's a change since Mill's day that would be a different kind of argument for government having a role. Mill didn't consider looking at the third bullet point about inequalities in society, and it is the case that dietary ill health in Western societies is linked to social class. So it is more likely to be a problem, including obesity but other forms of dietary ill health, for a problem from people from lower social classes than from higher social classes. And it could be said to be a valid role of the government to reduce social inequalities. Certainly in the United Kingdom, governments of all complexions say they want to do that. Whether they do it or not is another matter. And the top point about free riders, this is another point that Mill didn't appreciate because the concept hadn't been developed then, but by free rider I mean people who impose a burden on others in society, expecting them to pick up the pieces. Now, in the case of ill health, in the United Kingdom, since healthcare is paid by the taxpayer, the National Health Service, then anybody who harms themselves by profligate behavior is imposing a burden on everybody else because they're using up resources that are in limited supply that the taxpayer has provided. So one argument that people have used is if you want to eat a rotten diet and send yourself to an early grave but on the way get extremely sick and require treatment from the National Health Service, you should pay for it yourself rather than being a burden on the taxpayer. The difficulty with that argument is to say, well, where does it all stop? Supposing you decide to ride your bicycle and you get run over, because as I showed in my previous lecture, bike riding is pretty risky, particularly in cities, then should the health service say, we refuse to treat you because you chose to ride a bike and that's a risky activity? Is that any worse than choosing to eat an unhealthy diet? I don't know the answer. All I say is there are some arguments as to why the state might be justified in intervening to help people to improve their diets. But supposing there were a magic wand to wave and you could take some measures as a regulator to improve people's diets, what would it be? I used to get people saying to me when I was head of the Food Standards Agency, the anxious people at some cocktail party saying, it's outrageous that everybody's eating McDonald's hamburgers. You should ban McDonald's. And I say, that's fine. What about Burger King? You should ban Burger King. I say, what about Wendy's? You should ban Wendy's. What about KFC? You should ban KFC. Then I remind them that a cheese sandwich has got just as much fat and salt in it as a hamburger. You should ban cheese sandwiches. So where does it all end? It's pretty tricky. But when we looked at the evidence, there was one measure which we thought would be very effective, and we garnered the scientific evidence. And this is that there is, it's not really sort of crisp, hard experimental science, but there's some very good research, combination of experimental and observational, to show that children's diets are heavily influenced by food marketing. And obviously they would be, otherwise why would the food companies be marketing the food? And when we produced evidence to, here's some examples of food marketing to kids in English foods, probably similar in the States, we produced the evidence, and the food industry first of all said, that's ridiculous, food marketing and advertising has no effect on consumers. And when we said, well, why are you spending the money then? That seems a bit of a waste. They said, it's about brand loyalty. So it's not about whether the kid's going to eat chocolate or an apple. It's about eating Hershey bars versus Lion bars or whatever you have in America. And that's exactly what, of course, the tobacco industry said 20 or 30 years ago. It's not about encouraging people to smoke. It's about brand loyalty. But nevertheless, we produced such a convincing dossier of evidence collected by an academic from the University of Stirling called Gerard Hastings, that the food industry had nowhere to hide, but they did find a place to hide because they recruited another academic, a guy from Exeter University, and he did his own survey of the literature, and he concluded, opposite to our conclusion, that advertising and marketing has no effect on children's diets whatsoever. So we were confronted with two competing sets of evidence, rather the kind of thing I talked about on the previous lecture. So what I did then was to set up, with the agreement of the food industry, an independent review panel that would look at the two studies and come to a view about which study was rigorous or which study was more believable. And they concluded unambiguously that the industry study was pretty flaky, to say the least, and that our study was very robust. And so we did persuade the government to introduce some restrictions on the advertising of high-fat, high-salt, high-sugar food to children on television during children's viewing times. The trouble was that when the regulation was implemented, the crafty broadcast companies persuaded the government to restrict advertising on the programs that were, none of them were in the top 20 programs that children actually watch, because they succeeded in persuading the government that children's programs meant things that mummy and toddler watched in the middle of the day, whereas actually what we were interested in was children aged, say, 4 to 12, who watch prime viewing time programs in the early evening, around 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, and those are not designated as children's programs. They're often soaps and similar programs. So although there is a regulation to restrict advertising, it's extremely ineffective. And I think they could do more by being more stringent about the regulations. The other measure that you could introduce and that we encouraged the government to introduce, we failed, but one major food retailer, the second largest food retailer in Britain, did introduce it voluntarily. And what it was a modification of your front of pack nutrition panel. You have an extremely good large letters, clear front of pack nutrition panel introduced by the FDA, I guess, about 20 years ago. And what Sainsbury's, the second largest food retailer, did was to translate this front of pack nutrition label into a color-coded, what they call a wheel of health, where different nutrient ingredients, calories, fat, saturated fat, salt, and this is total sugars, fat, salt, saturated fat, sugar, and calories are represented by segments on this wheel. Red means it's high in relation to your GDA, guideline daily amount. Orange means it's kind of in between, and green means it's low. And they introduced this, and it had a dramatic effect on consumer choice. And here's one example. So you go into a Sainsbury's supermarket, and there's a whole raft of pizzas that you could buy. And it's pretty tricky to know which are the pizzas that would be low in those things and which are the ones that would be high, particularly if they're the same pizza, a ham and pineapple pizza. But Sainsbury's tried out by having two kinds of ham and pineapple pizza on sale, one which was all green on the wheel of health, and sales of that went up by 42%, and the other one, which was red, amber, and green mixed, the sales went down by 55%. On two very, very similar products. So consumer behavior was being driven by giving clear information. So we argued with the government, look, this is incredibly convincing. And even the second largest retailer in the country is saying this is the way to go on processed composite food products. But the government, persuaded by the other food retailers who didn't want to go down this route, rejected this as a way of influencing consumer behavior. So they didn't show much will to try and tackle the problem in, I think, the two ways that would have been relatively easy to implement and would not really have been restricting people's freedom and people's choice of diet. It would be simply providing some signposts or some constraints on the industry on what they promote. Now, the government's view is that this is really all a matter of individual choice, and I guess that's probably your administration's view here. But this final slide in this section, I just want to say that choice isn't necessarily all it's cracked up to be. And here's a rather amusing quote from Barry Schwartz's book that came out a few years ago, The Paradox of Choice, which describes how he went into Gap to try and buy a pair of jeans and was overwhelmed by the choice he got, stonewashed, acid washed, distressed, button or zipper, fly, faded or regular. And he says, I only want the jeans that I always wore. And he describes how he staggered out of the shop half an hour later, completely exhausted. And the theme of his book, which is a great read if any of you haven't looked at it, is that actually in modern life we are stifled by choice. You go into a supermarket to buy chicken soup, and there are 60 varieties of chicken soup. How do you know which one to buy? And he sort of makes the graphic point that as we look through our evolutionary history, when we were hunter-gatherers, we spent a lot of the time just getting enough food to survive. It was a very difficult, stressful job. As we moved to an agricultural society and food became more plentiful, we had time to do other stuff like play music or go to the theater or fight wars. And now we are sort of moving back to the hunter-gatherer stage where shopping, if you really want to exercise choice, is so complex that it's almost as bad as being a hunter-gatherer. If you really want to be sure you're getting the right chicken soup, you're getting the right pizza, you have to spend a long, long time studying the options, reading the labels, and figuring out which one to get. So choice is not always a magic solution to lifestyle and individual behavior. But I now want to turn in the last 5 to 10 minutes of my talk to the fourth question, which is talking about all, because I've really only talked about us, the privileged, in Western rich societies. But as you know, we are in an unusual position in that we have more than enough food to eat, and our health and nutrition problem is, if anything, overnutrition, whereas for well over 1 billion people, if you include nutrient deficiencies, the problem is not getting enough, is starvation or undernourishment. rather like the slide I showed of the soldier at the beginning of the 20th century in the United Kingdom. And if you project forward, that problem is likely to get worse, because there are over 1 billion people today with increasing world population, and the increasing demand for food here estimated by the UN, demand for food is going to increase by 50% by 2030, and between figures, of course, get more uncertain as you go further out, but something like 70 to 100% by 2050. So the question in this last part of the talk is it going to be easy to provide enough food for everybody, given that there are already one in six people in the world who are starving or undernourished in some nutritional deficiency? Well, one kind of answer is the kind of optimistic answer that says, hey, it's not a problem, because if you look at the results of the Green Revolution, per capita food production has gone up hugely over the last 60 years, 50 years. So on average, although there are many more people on the Earth's surface, on average there's 25% more food per person than there was in 1961. And that's true whether you look at crops or whether you look at meat production. So why don't we just carry on being more efficient, producing more, as we've done in the last 50 years? And the Green Revolution resulted from the application of a range of technologies, including genetics, including irrigation, including fertilizer application and mechanization. But those who've looked at this problem, and many will be aware of this, consider that these glowing pictures of what's happened in the past are unlikely to project effectively into the future, for a number of reasons, of which I mention half a dozen. One of them is that the gains in terms of production efficiency of the Green Revolution have reached a plateau. The second is that certain resources that have been required in increasing productivity are in short supply, notably water. The third is that we now realize, looking back, that the Green Revolution, whilst great, was bought at a price, and the price was environmental degradation. There were so-called externalities, costs in terms of pollution, loss of biodiversity, and other natural resources that weren't factored in. So we haven't got this for nothing. And fourthly, there's increasing competition for land, because people are trying to grow, in my view mistakenly, biofuels in agricultural land, and that's using up land that could be used to feed people. And fifthly, there's the impact of climate change, which may make it more difficult to grow food in certain parts of the world, and is certainly likely to increase water stress in the already water-stressed parts of the world. And finally, sixthly, there is the nutritional transition. As people get richer, more like us, they want to have a fancier diet, and they're not happy just to have rice all day. They want to have steaks like we have. And as you all know, meat is more costly in terms of land and resources to produce than grain, than cereals. So for all those reasons, it's unlikely that we can just project forward and say we'll happily sail on improving the output of food. Here are two examples just to illustrate the point. This is the declining growth rate of productivity. So here is the global yield growth of wheat, maize, rice, and soya between 1961 and 1990, and then in the last 17 years between 1990 and 2007. And the main point to see is the dark blue bars are shorter than the light blue bars, so the gains of the Green Revolution have begun to run out of steam. The technologies that were applied had their benefit, and that benefit has now reaching a plateau. And on the other side of the slide, you can see how, in one particular case, the rate of growth of world population, it is indeed slowing down, but not slowing down as fast as rice yield is slowing down. So rice yield is diminishing relative to the number of people appearing on the Earth's surface. And here's another example, which is, I think, probably the most likely limiting resource in the next 30 or 40 years, is fresh water. Fresh water availability per head of world population going steadily down, according to UNEP, from 1950 to 2030. And most of that water, two-thirds of it, is used in food production. What about land? Well, if you look at the Green Revolution, it's really been geographically specific. It's been it's doubled per capita productivity in Asia, increased it by 1.6 per person in Latin America, but had been no increase in Africa. So if you just look at what's happened this is plotting yield against area. So here is Asia. The area under cultivation has hardly gone up, but yield has gone up hugely from the white square in 1961 to the green square in 2001, 128 to 282. That increase has been achieved using the same amount of land by increased efficiency of agriculture, the Green Revolution. In Africa, there's been rather little change in terms of yield. In fact, the yields now are virtually the same as they were 50 years ago, and the only way that productivity has increased is by putting more land under agriculture. So the real issue in most urgent is how to improve agricultural production in Africa. And an optimistic view of how this can be achieved is in Kalestos Juma's latest book, which came out late last year. And what he points out is that Africa can learn the lessons of the Green Revolution and kind of leapfrog over the technologies that were deployed in the period 1960 to 2000, because those had their shortcomings. They led to environmental degradation, excessive use of natural resources, such as water. So he thinks that using a combination of information technology, GIS, biotech, and nanotechnology, Africa can actually, he's very optimistic, he thinks they can leapfrog over the rest of us and start producing food in a way that is doubly green. So it's green in the sense of good, sustainable, and also green in the sense of producing more for everybody to eat. So that's one very optimistic view. It remains to be seen whether he is right or not. But I think the general argument that he makes is right, that in order to meet the challenge, we need to deploy every technology in the toolbox and not throw technologies away. And this brings me back to the issue of rejection of biotechnology in Europe, because I'm not claiming that biotechnology, genetic engineering, is the answer, but it is a tool in the toolbox that might be able to deliver certain benefits. And there's a very compelling account of how these benefits are not being transferred to sub-Saharan Africa in Robert Pahlberg's book, in which he says, and I summarize here, that in this slide, that many governments in Africa, out of deference to the European example, have driven GM crops away. So they are asking the question, well, if Europe doesn't like it, there must be something wrong with it. And a most striking example that, to me, I'll just skip over that one, was back in 2002 when the president of Zambia rejected food aid. There was a crop failure, and many people in Zambia were starving, and the United States offered food aid in the form of maize, but the maize was GM, and this is what the president of Zambia said: simply because my people are hungry, it's no justification to give them food that is intrinsically dangerous to their health. And he came over to Britain at that time with a group of experts to say to people like me, well, if you reckon this stuff is fine for us to eat, how come you guys aren't eating it? If you've turned it down, there must be some trick here. You're trying to foist it off on us. And it was pretty hard to explain, well, no, it's fine for you, it's just that we don't eat it. And of course, I should have said to him, well, go over to the States and check with them, and he probably did, but nevertheless, he rejected food aid for those reasons. The previous slide that I just jumped over, I should mention that another change that Pahlberg highlights, which is very bad for African technology development, is that the major rich countries have slashed their agricultural aid budgets in their development budgets over the last 20 years. So the US had 25% of its bilateral aid is as agricultural aid 20 years in 1983, and that was cut to 1%. So bilateral aid was not including agricultural technology, and the same is true for the UK, France, and Germany. So one of Pahlberg's arguments, which is also echoed by Kalestos Juma, is that if Africa is to develop the technologies, including biotechnology, but others, they're going to need our support in order for them to develop their own capacity to build the academic base and the skills to deliver those technologies. Just to give one example, and I'm not going to go on about this because I'm not really an advocate for biotechnology per se. As I say, I think it's just one of the approaches that ought to be taken. These are, in China, drought-resistant crops being grown in a arid desert area, genetically modified, and this also indicates the loss of crops due to pests and diseases across the world, and much of that loss, it's possible, could be reduced by using biotechnology. But food waste is not just a problem of the developing world. So here is the pattern of food waste in developing countries is mainly on farm and during post-harvest, during transport and process. In the United States and the UK, on-farm losses are much smaller. Most of the food waste is in retail, in restaurants, and this huge bar in the home. So the fact is that we throw away a lot of food that is perfectly good to eat, partly because restaurants have too much and they check it out at the end of the day, partly because we buy stuff that we can't consume within its sell-by date and we chuck it away, and so on. And there's another question here about how effectively food waste could be reduced in the Western world to provide more surplus to send to other people. And again, this is a question. I don't have an answer as to whether the kind of promotions that retailers operate, certainly the United Kingdom, maybe here, encouraging through what's called in the United Kingdom a bog-off, buy one, get one free, encouraging to buy more stuff than you actually need, so you end up throwing it away. And certainly there are those who are trying to encourage supermarkets to stop doing that and stop selling things in very large packages, so you have to use some of it and throw the rest away. But it's very difficult to make headway on that approach. I now want to just in the very last minute talk about one of the other factors that I listed, which is in increasing food production, we also have to be aware of the greenhouse gases that are emitted as a result of food production if we are going to try and reduce our carbon footprint. And I'm going to talk about this more on Monday, but this is the United Kingdom's greenhouse gas inventory in 1990, and agriculture was about 8% of our greenhouse gas emissions. This is a plan to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, which I'm going to talk about more on Monday, to 2050, and by that stage, agriculture will be this dark green blob, about nearly a third of our greenhouse gas emissions. So if you extrapolate this up worldwide, if we are serious about tackling climate change, we have to tackle greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture as part of the package. And that in itself, on top of having to produce more food, produces an additional technological challenge. How are we going to do that? It's worth just reminding ourselves that in the food we eat, the greenhouse gas emissions that come from production, which are farming, fertilizers, pesticides, machinery, etc., it actually should say 33%. It says 3%, it's a misprint, it's about a third of it. Then net trade in the United Kingdom is imported food, but households, catering, retail, transport, etc., are also part of the picture. So if we're thinking of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions from food, we have to think more widely than agriculture. But just thinking of agriculture per se, there has to be an application of technology to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. Now, one answer to that, which the chairman of the IPCC, Raj Pachauri, has indicated, is maybe we should all become vegetarians. Is that the answer? Would that reduce our greenhouse gas emissions as well as helping us to feed the world? Well, looking at greenhouse gas emissions from different kinds of foods, it's not that straightforward. This is the emissions intensity, kilograms of CO2 equivalent per kilogram of product, and you can see red meat, sheep meat, and beef are dreadful villains, but tomatoes are about the same as poultry, and eggs about the same as tomatoes, milk, bread, and potatoes down here. So it's not simply that all meat is worse in terms of its greenhouse gas emissions, its carbon footprint, than all vegetables. It all depends on how they're produced. So we can't simply solve the problem by becoming vegetarians. We have to look at how different kinds of food are produced. And of course, this graph, as you'll realize, this chart, is misleading because it doesn't actually tell you about the nutritional composition of these. It's only kilograms of product, and you have to take into account the nutritional composition, and the nutritional composition of chicken is very different from that of potatoes. Whatever people would like to do about vegetarianism, the global trend, of course, is for developing countries to eat more meat. As people get richer, they change to want to eat meat. So I'm going to stop there because I've run out of time, but what I want to say in conclusion is that in looking at the question of safe and healthy food for all, we have two opposing trends currently at the moment. We have the problem of overnutrition in the developed world and food shortage in the developing world. Both of those problems, tackling them, involve some element of technology, but some element of social change. They're not going to be solved either by technology or by social change, but by some combination of both. And that, I think, is a challenge for all of us for the future. Thank you. I realise I've just gone on a bit longer than I should have done, so if people want to rush out, they're welcome to do so. But I'm happy to answer any questions, if there are any. Stunned silence. Yeah. I think the technological solutions are to use water more efficiently, and there are some striking examples in Israel of efficient water use in growing crops in the desert, but also the role for biotechnology will be to develop plants that are more less needy for water, more drought resistant. So I think it's going to be a combination of better irrigation and either plant breeding or genetic engineering of plants to make them need less water. That would be my view. Well, the problem with desalination is that it brings in the other part of the equation, which is reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And unless you power it by solar energy, it's a very costly process. Now, in some parts of the world, you probably could power it by solar energy, but in many parts of the world, you won't be able to because there isn't enough energy in solar power to power it. But it's a fact, it could be a consequence or have a role in some parts of the world. Yeah, at the back.
I'd like you to address the possibility of using price to regulate food choice. 2 days ago, you referred to price as a possible controller for beer consumption.
Yeah.
And the tradition has been not to tax food.
Yeah.
And yet huge subsidies are given to some farmers.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an idea that's hotly promoted by many food campaigners. And I read on the web about 6 months ago that Denmark had introduced a fat tax, a tax on food containing a lot of fat. And I emailed my friends that I knew who knew about the Danish system, and they were completely unaware of it. So it may be, I don't know, maybe there's somebody from Denmark here who can enlighten us. The general argument against it in the United Kingdom is that it would be a regressive tax because it would generally, the people who are most prone to eat the unhealthy kinds of food are the poorest people in society. And there are a whole raft of reasons why they choose to do that or why they do it. It may not be even much of a choice. It may be what's available. But if you introduced a tax on fat in food, it would certainly be a regressive tax. So the affluent middle classes would kind of exercise their choice to avoid eating those foods, which they probably are doing anyway, and they would avoid the tax. So that's the strongest argument, in my view, against it, even though it might well have some, I don't know what the price elasticity of potato chips is, but it might well have some disincentive effect, as with alcohol.
What about the reverse? Governments subsidizing healthy
Yeah.
Well,
that's a very interesting case, and actually there's both academic literature on that and a current initiative in the UK. So the current initiative in the UK is called the Great Swapathon, where you can get vouchers, which are sponsored by food companies, to give you a discount on certain kinds of food, and it's focused on healthy foods, so things like fruit and vegetables. And in order to get these vouchers, you have to buy the most disgusting Sunday newspaper called the News of the World, and buying the, anybody who's been in the United Kingdom knows it's sort of like the National Enquirer but bigger, and you have to buy the newspaper and you cut out these vouchers and take them along to one of the major supermarkets, the third largest supermarket, and you get these, you know, you get a discount on some fruit or vegetables or brown bread. Anyway, there's been academic research on this scheme because it's been tried in other countries. And what happens is really obvious once it's pointed out. People go into the supermarket with their weekly money that they're going to spend on their weekly shop. They get the discount on the healthier stuff, and they just buy more of the unhealthy stuff with the money they saved. So it actually has no beneficial effect whatsoever on people's diets. And we have pointed this out to the government, but they seem to be blind to the evidence. It's quite well studied. There have been a number of policy instruments like that. So discounting the healthy food doesn't necessarily produce the answer you might hope for.
You mentioned agriculture and greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah.
And I know there's been a lot of talk about food miles, and I understand that in some supermarkets in the UK now they're putting food miles on food products.
Yeah.
The implication being that we should eat more local foods rather than food sourced from far away.
Yeah.
Do you think eating locally will have a significant impact on greenhouse gas emissions?
It's on this slide here, in fact. I've just taken my pointer out. But if you look to transportation is 9% of the greenhouse gas emissions from the food chain. So it does, if you switch from eating green beans from Kenya to eating green beans grown in Ithaca, you will save greenhouse gas emissions. Maybe bad for the farmers in Kenya, that's another matter. But it's not going to be a major contributor to reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the food chain, because it turns out that food miles are not as a big deal as people thought when you stack up the numbers. And indeed, the transportation greenhouse gas emissions are, if you look at what that 9% breaks out into, getting in your four-wheel drive to go to the supermarket out of town is a bit worse than the beans being air freighted in from Kenya, because when they're freighted in from Kenya, of course, you bring a huge number in a freighter transport plane. When you go in the supermarket and you buy 5 days' worth of shopping, the expenditure of greenhouse gases relative to the amount of food you harvest is much higher. So, yes, food miles could have a role to play, but no, it's not all it's cracked up to be. And there may be lots of other reasons for wanting to buy local food, just as there may be lots of reasons for wanting to buy food produced by poor people in developing countries. It's a pretty complicated thing, and there are lots of competing views amongst NGOs about this. Yeah. Well, in one slide that I skipped over, one of the other initiatives that the UK government has taken is to improve the nutritional content of school meals, and they've injected quite a lot of extra money. When I was head of the Food Standards Agency, the amount of money that was spent by the public authorities on a school dinner for a school kid was less than the amount of money that the army spends on a dinner for a dog. So army dogs were getting a higher rating than school kids. So they did change that. They improved the quality of school meals. And the idea of that was that that would then change the food culture of children. In fact, it's had mixed results. One of the things that happened when they moved from burger and fries to salads was that the kids stopped eating school meals and brought their own burger and fries into school. So the number of children taking up school meals dropped by 17% in the schools where this initiative had taken place. So it's tricky. I agree with, I think you're right, that education does have a role to play. But again, it's when you look at the conditions under which many of the poorest people in the United Kingdom live, and I'm sure the same as in the United States, there are no shops nearby that sell fresh fruit and vegetables. They're in what are called by the food campaigners food deserts. They don't own cars, so it's not enough to say, drive your car out to the supermarket and get your fruit and vegetables there. So they don't have access. They often be living in very restricted accommodation with restricted cooking facilities. They may just have a single ring. So it's a much more complicated social problem than educating people, although education clearly has a role. There are whole issues about social inequalities and what we do about people who live in very difficult conditions. Which is why I listed a justification for intervening is to reduce inequalities, which I don't know what the US government's view on that is, but certainly in the UK, governments of both complexions, right and left, say they are committed to reducing inequalities. And the previous government, Labour government, in fact, put huge amounts of money into poor communities to try and improve health and education and well-being with some effect. I mean, it did make a bit of difference. Paul, you're only allowed to ask a question if it's a nice one. Thank you. Paul is an old friend of mine, that's why I said that to him. Yep.
Am I hearing right here who thinks that your notions about the future are pretty glum and that our only what we need is not better technology or even better science. What we need is a better political system.
We need both. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We should shoot the politicians.
Well, shoot may be a bit harsh. I mean, why have we got the politicians we've got? It's because we've elected them. So shoot yourself, maybe. But I didn't mean that, Paul. No, I mean, I agree. It does sound a bit of a cop-out to say it's complicated, but what I'm trying not to be is sort of technologically simplistic, saying if only we could get people to apply the technology, that would be the solution to everything, because these things are socio-political problems as well. And
I wasn't accusing you of being simplistic. Oh. Very simple. But what the trend of the whole lecture seems to be suggesting to me is that we need to be better at doubtless electing our politicians.
Yeah.
What proportion of the MPs in the UK Parliament have a scientific education?
I think out of the 650 members of the House of Commons, two have science PhDs and probably about another 25 have science first degrees. But that's not, I don't think that's necessarily the crucial metric. After all, by many people's view, the most damaging prime minister we've had in the last 100 years was a scientist. Maggie Thatcher had a degree in chemistry. And many people think that she didn't do a good job. You know, she did. Some people think she was brilliant, but many of us have certain reservations about what she did.
But the UK Parliament is full of lawyers who
yes.
understand law.
Yeah.
It needs a few people who read the science, doesn't it?
Yes, well, that's important to have the House of Lords, because there are more scientists in the House of Lords. Touché. I mean, that is a common view, and in one sense it's true. Gordon Conway, who used to run the Rockefeller Foundation that funds a lot of research on agricultural development, he said once when asked this question, and I think it's a great quote, so I'm going to use it, he said, yes, it is a distribution, just like there's no poverty in the world, it's just that Bill Gates has got it all. And, you know, it's true. There is no poverty in the world. It's just that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have got most of it, most of the wealth. Why don't they just redistribute it? Well, the answer is it ain't realistic for them to distribute their money so everybody is equalized in wealth. So distribution is important. There is overproduction in some parts of the world, but it ain't realistic to assume that we can solve the world's problems of hunger by distribution. Nor, actually, do I think it's morally right, because I think in the long run, and the not-so-long run, hopefully, one should not have countries that are dependent on handouts. I mean, you know, if I were in Zambia, I would rather have my own agricultural system producing the food that I want rather than having to wait for the US or Europe to hand me stuff when I was hungry. So I think I would argue that, A, it ain't realistic to assume that food will be redistributed, and B, it isn't necessarily morally the right answer. I think we should be encouraging more self-sufficiency.
I like that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much indeed.